stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with the delightful Brian Sills. Brian is here in Sarasota as part of the ensemble company of The Heidi Chronicles, which is currently playing at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. I like to think that Brian has the Muppets to thank for his career in theatre. They inspired him, and by the time he was six, he was creating puppet shows for his friends and his family and his classmates in school. Brian's story is interesting, not exactly like everyone else's, which is true for all of us, isn't it? So, hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
It's all about being the person you really are and living the life you were meant to live. If you've heard the show before, you know that I'm a psychotherapist. And as a psychotherapist, I see people every day and have done for the last 30 years, most of whom are not behaving as who they really are. In fact, most of whom don't actually know who they really are. Now, obviously, this is on some kind of continuum. So some people have a quality for which they are in denial. Some people are in denial for most of who they really are. And it's not rocket science. It's pretty obvious that if you have to keep secrets about yourself, about who you are, from yourself and the rest of the world, of course, that takes tremendous energy, and that energy will be taken from what you can do, who you can be, what you can achieve in the world. But in addition, there will be a sense of being out of sync with yourself. A lot of people describe this, you know, as being a fraud. If you really knew me, then you wouldn't like me. This kind of sense that there's something about you that's flawed or bad or unattractive. And that something is a quality, an attribute, a way of being, a way of thinking that you had to deny in your childhood. This can happen because you have a quality which your parents are made uncomfortable by. I have a client whose mother had a very obstreperous family. They were loud, they were boisterous. She was the littlest, and she was frightened by all of this noise. And so she, Mummy, grew up not wanting to have a lot of noise, being made uncomfortable, even frightened by outbursts, even outbursts of pleasure, joy, delight. So she stamped down pretty hard on her little girl when her little girl was exuberant, when she was joyous, when she was happy, when she was delighted, when she was thrilled, when she was scared, when she was hurt, when she was angry. And so this client now has a governor. I don't know how many of you know what a governor is. I'm aware that it has become an old-fashioned term. It's cars used to have governors on their gas pedal so that you could only depress it so far, so you could only go so far. So a governor in this context is the stop button that my client has on anything that seems like a large outburst. Well, this means she can't be very angry and she can't be very happy. She mostly thought of herself in this way and accepted it because she had learned very, very early to put this governor on those feelings. But of course, a life without the ability to be as happy as you are, as joyful as you are, as angry as you are, as frightened as you are, is a diminished life. And it doesn't feel good. And so, of course, this woman finally came into therapy saying, I feel stuck. But the reality is that her ability to be outrageously joyous, to be really angry, it's still there. She didn't lose it. You can't amputate aspects of yourself. But she's in denial for it, for a very good reason, because every time her emotions threaten to get, quote, out of control, the governor kicks in. The flash of her mother's disapproving face, or her mother's frightened face, because her mother was frightened by these outbursts, and it slams down the emotion. So, this woman is not who she really is. She's a version of herself. And in my experience, most of us are versions of ourselves, not the complete and whole who we are. And it is my job as a psychotherapist and also the point of view of the Lynn Show, the reason I do it, to make this point over and over again. Perhaps there is a way in which you are not being who you really are. And it is my hope that listening to me talk about this will stimulate, trigger, motivate, inspire you to think about that. If, as I am talking, you do think that there is some aspect of yourself which you are in denial for, have not had access to, and therefore are being cheated out of, and you want to attempt to reconstruct it, rediscover it, so you can have it, I recommend a number of things. Psychotherapy with me or someone else. If you wanted to be in therapy with me, you would need to do that on the telephone because that's the only way I do it these days. And I have written an article about psychotherapy on the phone, which you can get at my website. It's called Therapy on the Go. And the website is, and I will try and remember to say it again at the end of the show, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. At the website, you can also get a copy of my book, and you can listen to and even download the podcasts of the interviews that I do in my show. I do interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because when you listen to them talk about their work, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And again, I hope be inspired to go searching for anything you might have had to hide. So today, I'm playing an interview with Brian Sills, who is more and more who he really is. And you will hear Brian talk later in the interview about going deeper, finding more and more about himself. This is often true for actors, good actors anyway, because they need to use the real them on stage. Even when the character they're playing is not anything like the real them, they need to find the way in which it is real for them. And when you listen to Brian, you are hearing someone who is dedicated to that. Also, Brian is a wonderful singer, although he doesn't get to use that in the Heidi Chronicles, which was the impetus for this interview. But Brian sent me some examples of his vocal talent, and I'm going to play a little clip before the interview, and then I think we're going to go out on another clip of Brian singing. So here is Brian Sills singing and then talking.
I was there, and the way he looked so debonair as he laid them all low. From the tree I could see every blow. You can take it from me, I should know.
I am here with Brian Sills in a little conference room at the Oslo.
It's very nice. I wish you could all be here.
Yes. They are all here.
They are all here.
That's right. And Brian is here because he's in the Heidi Chronicles, which is running now at the Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
And I will explain to Brian that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I think that must be what you're doing.
It is what I'm doing.
It is what you're doing, right. And I only ask one question, and that is, how did you discover it? Not, you know, when did you get your first job or anything like that, but what was the very first moment in life that it occurred to you that taking on a character, being in front of people, liking stories, I don't know. Do you know what I'm asking?
I do know what you're asking, I think. And from a very young age, I started to put on little plays and little shows. Very young age. I would say kindergarten age, say about six.
Six? You were putting on little...
I would put on, like, puppet shows for friends, for my family, at school.
Okay, wait. Where did you get the puppets?
I had, like, just sort of, like, toy puppets and stuff that I just had. Like, mostly, like, Muppets and things like that.
And so, spontaneously, you just picked them up and started to make them do things?
Started to make them do things. And I had... My mom had, I remember, in the basement, this giant framed, like, cork board.
Mm-hmm.
That I guess you could have hung on a wall, but it was just leaning against the wall. And it was quite large. Well, maybe not as large as I think, but I was little at the time.
Yes,
so it seemed huge. It was big enough for me to prop it up against a chair and hide behind it and do shows.
Oh, yes.
And I would do it at the bottom of the stairs in the basement. I haven't thought about this in a very long time. At the bottom of the stairs to the basement so that people could sit on the stairs. So there were stadium seating.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. And I would do little shows.
Oh, no, wait. I am willing to believe that you picked up a puppet and started to make it do stuff. But this thing, this suggests you saw something. I mean, did you invent performance by yourself? I mean,
No,
do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I think perhaps the puppet thing comes from, I think, an immediate connection with the Muppets. I remember, like, growing up watching Sesame Street, watching the Muppet Show, and always loving them. And being fascinated by them. I remember there was an exhibit that came to Toronto. I grew up in Toronto. That came to Toronto. It was a Muppet exhibit that sort of showed the behind the scenes, and you got to see the actual Muppets in these cases. And my dad took me to see it, and I was through the roof with excitement. I could not believe I was, like, looking through this pane of glass at
a Muppet.
At Kermit the Frog, at Miss Piggy, at Fozzie. And it was just thrilling to me.
And how old were you?
I would say I was quite young then still. definitely younger than 10. I would say probably in the 6 to 8 area. And still, I think still young enough to believe that there's something magical and real about these characters that isn't attached to a human, that they are, you know, that they are living, that they exist.
Yeah, yeah, that they
exist. And then to also then be fascinated by what you would see, like little movies in this exhibit and photos of the people working the Muppets, of the actual Muppeteers, and Jim Henson.
Right.
And just, I remember just being incredibly inspired by the creativity of these, of Jim Henson, and that whole, everything he created.
Yeah. It turned you on.
Big time.
Big time, right.
Big time.
Okay, and so now this makes a lot of sense, then, that you would then be drawn to that as a way of expressing your own creativity, right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the kinds of things you did with these puppets? Anything you called them, or any of the stories, or what they did with each other?
I don't.
But you remember the experience.
I remember the experience of doing it, and I would even I would take it into the school. I took puppets to school, and I would do little shows. I would, and then by the time I sort of got into like grade one through, even through six, really, I would start to adapt. I did a couple of my own stories, but I would adapt movies that I liked for our class to perform. I would rewrite the script. And
You said, teacher, I have this script I'd like the class to do. Are you serious?
Yeah.
So, and they said, fine, bring
teachers,
in the...
Teachers loved it.
Loved it.
I was blessed that I had a lot of teachers that absolutely encouraged my creativity, that did not attempt to stifle it at all.
This is really interesting. You know, this week I'm hearing a lot about teachers and the incredible influence.
Absolutely. I think there's nothing, teachers are... Teachers are incredible people, and I think there's, especially if it is truly an incredible teacher,
someone who
can recognize in each child their individuality, that not everybody learns the same way, not everyone is experiencing life in the same way, and life is complex even when you're little.
Yes.
And who knows what's going on in the homes of all these kids, and do you know what I mean? And yet, in that moment, in that room, if they can recognize that kid and see them for who they are, see their authenticity, then, and encourage that.
Yeah.
And say, I see that in you, and I encourage that in you, and I think that's, and I like that.
And I like that about you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I think that's really important.
There's no way to overemphasize it. Twice now, in this week, actually, interviewed a guy who said he was a scaredy-cat, shy kid.
Mm.
And he named the teacher, and he said she picked him out and assigned him a speaking gig of some kind, which he did, and it changed his life.
Yeah.
And somebody else I interviewed recently had a bad stutter, and the teacher said, you can do this, do this.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And these lives completely changed by that.
Completely.
So, okay, so you're in this wonderful environment soup where, you know, you get to say, well, I think this is a good idea. I'd like to do this.
Yeah.
Teacher says, fine. Everybody does it, right?
Yeah, I would cast the class. Write roles for them. And
did you actually act, or were you just the producer-director?
No, I was the, I believe I wrote for myself.
You were
the star. I won't lie. I wrote for me. I wrote myself some pretty good roles. Mostly in the movies that I would adapt for all the roles that I wanted to play. Like, and they were never quite usually the lead. It was always like either the villain.
The villain.
Or the funny guy. Or if there's a nice combo of both. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, do you remember any?
I did like a Peter Pan one, and I was Captain Hook.
Not Peter Pan.
No. Who wants to be Peter Pan when you can be Captain Hook? And then I did one of Superman, if you remember Superman 2, which I came out during my childhood, and I loved it. And there's these three villains that were all in black from the same planet that Superman came from. And one of the leader of the three was General Zod, and I made myself General Zod, and I cast another guy to be Superman. The play wasn't really about Superman, it was about Zod. So.
Yes, of course. It's lovely.
Yeah.
So, okay, so here we have you really captured by this whole idea of stories and fantasy and acting and all that, not to mention directing and, you know, right, and writing and all that stuff. So, okay, this is elementary school. Then what happens?
Continued through high school. I had really great teachers who encouraged my creativity. One of the big things that happened, actually, was when I was in junior high, this summer that I was leaving junior high, actually. It was the end of the summer, and I was sort of, you know, I guess it was 13, 14, however old you are there, and starting to get a little restless, and my mom's like, I gotta do something with this kid. And there's a community theater down the street from where I grew up, the Scarborough Players. And my mom saw a little ad in the paper saying they were looking for volunteers to come in and help paint sets and stuff like that. And she took me down and literally dropped me off. She said, my kid loves theater. Here he is.
Take him.
And they did. And they welcomed me in.
Again.
And they welcomed me in. And there I was painting sets. And then before I knew it, I was on the backstage crew. I loved it. And this company... of really tremendous people welcomed me in, and I ended up meeting a man who ended up sort of being, well, he continues to be one of my best friends, and he was sort of a mentor to me through most of my life, and met him there on that production. He was a teacher, and I did several productions, some on stage, some, I did both on stage and backstage for this company for years.
So you were acting even then in high school?
Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't get cast in any of the high school shows because I was too young in those first years, like grade 9, grade 10. They were casting all the older kids for the main roles. So I was going somewhere else to get the work.
Of course you were.
And then I remember in grade 11, the head of the drama department said, so when are you going to come act for us? I said, well, as soon as you... I was wheeling and dealing back then for work. Who knew? And then eventually, once I was a senior and all that, I started getting the good roles in high school. And it was around that time that I made the decision that I was going to... decision.
I was going to ask that question. Was there ever any doubt?
I've sort of flipped back and forth. I come from a family of police officers. Everyone is in the police department.
Oh, my.
And, or works for the police in some form or another. And my parents, my sister's a police officer, but I was the family black sheep. I wasn't really a rebel. I just knew I didn't want to. There were periods of time that I think I wanted to do that, because I think, you know, any young boy wants to be a fireman or a cop for at least 15 minutes in his life. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
But I knew that wasn't the route for me. And I always knew I was, it had to be a creative field of some kind for me, because I just knew that I was never good with math and science. I tried, but my brain couldn't, I had tutors and I would go for extra help, and I just never really flourished in that area. But where I did shine was in English and the creativity and music and drama. And
music?
Mm-hmm.
So...
I sang. I studied classical singing.
Where?
In Toronto with a great teacher.
High school?
During high school and a little bit in junior high. He was actually my junior high music teacher. Tremendous man. His name's Mark. And we're still in touch to this day.
So now, how did your family feel about this?
My mom and my dad have also, they've been very encouraging of me.
Even given that you were not going to go into the family business.
Yeah, they were thrilled that I didn't want to go into the family business.
Oh.
They were actually not so thrilled that my sister
went into it. Right.
But they knew that wouldn't be my path. And they cautioned me. They're like, if this is where you want to go, that's fine. But know that it's not an easy path.
Well, but they didn't make it hard for you. I mean, they let you take the voice lessons.
Voice lessons. I also played percussion in the school band, and then ended up being in a marching band. I was in the police pipes and drums, the Toronto Police pipes and drums band for a couple of years as a drummer, as a snare drummer, and then studied classical singing with Mark for many years, and then continued to study music through high school, and then in my last 2 years, I really made the decision. This is what I'm going to do with my life. I really want to do this. And started auditioning for all the major theater schools, the ones in Canada and a couple in the United States, too.
So what happened?
Well, the first school I auditioned for was Juilliard. I went down to New York. My mom, bless her heart, again, she was very encouraging, and I had never been to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I decided, I want to go to the best. I want to go to the best school you can go to, and could it get any better than Juilliard?
Right.
And so we went down to New York in the middle of February, my final year of high school, and I auditioned. And did not get in. I didn't even get a call back. Mm-hmm. I was very young. I was young and a little green, you know, naive. But I did my best.
Right.
I poured my heart into it and did my best. Didn't get in. I was pretty upset about that. but went back to Canada and then auditioned for several universities that had strong theater departments. The Ryerson Theater School, which is where I ended up going, which again is a classical conservatory theater school in Toronto. And Ryerson was actually my second choice. It was an amazing time. And I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, and so suddenly in university I moved downtown. Suddenly I was a big man on campus.
Yeah. I'm assuming from your smile that the college experience was a good thing.
It was a good thing. I think I always stand by anyone who asks me about going into this business. I'm like, well, I think training is important. Creativity is important. But you also, I think there are some fundamental techniques in terms of being an actor that you need to understand and grasp.
So this actually brings up an interesting thing. Because you started so young and you developed on your own, essentially, your own style, your own impulses, was it difficult? Did you have to unlearn, or did they just add? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I do. I think a bit of both. It's funny. I had a singing teacher in my first year at university at Ryerson who was not very nice. And he had a very specific way of teaching singing. And it was his way or the highway. Mm. And he threw out a lot of very famous names that he has taught. Mm-hmm. And he is indeed the key to singing success. And I had studied classical singing, and he was more sort of pop, musical theatery kind of sound. This is what he was aiming to get out of us. And first day of this band's class, he had us all get up and sing a little something, so he could know our voices. We all got up and sang, and I got up and sang, and I think I was probably the only one with any sort of training. And he stopped halfway through, and he said, "Do you hear that? He will never work with that voice."
Oh my God.
Ever. But thank God I'm here.
Oh, dear God.
Because I can help him. No, sit down. It was really devastating.
It
went inward, right, and right. I didn't want to sing for the rest of that
I'm
year.
Sure
I didn't
you
want
did.
To open my mouth.
Right, I'm sure.
And then they fired him. Thank you, karma. And they brought in a man who also became a great friend and mentor to me. His name is David Walden. Tremendous teacher, singer, actor. Huge, huge heart. Just adored this man. And he rescued a lot of us. Because this man intimidated me, but he intimidated a lot of people in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us found singing to be a joyous experience, which it should be. And David helped us to connect with the joy of singing again. And to be fearless again. And just sing. And he was a great influence. He's a great influence singing-wise, but he was also a great influence in my life and my heart. So, yeah.
Lovely. You were very lucky.
I've been very lucky. Mm-hmm. I've had some amazing mentors and people to sort of point the way and to help and encourage me along the way. I've been very lucky. I've met with very little to no resistance in this path.
It couldn't have anything to do with you.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
I know how talented you are because I've seen you on stage, but you're also open and alive, you know.
I try to be. I've had my struggles. When I say I haven't met resistance, I mean in terms of people that love and care about me and have always encouraged me. I've met resistance in this business because that's the nature of show business.
That's right.
And that you go through times where you're very busy and then other times you feel like you couldn't get arrested.
You'll never get another job.
And that's hard. And it's hard to navigate those and not take those personally. It's like, well, what's wrong with me? Why am I failing? Have I gone the wrong way?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I still continue to battle with to some extent.
Well, I would like to get to that, actually. So, okay, so you graduate. Then
yes.
What happens?
So I graduate, and I started working right away. I was a very lucky teacher at our school. We were starting this brand new theater festival, and there's this beautiful theater, the Regent Theater, and we were the first season, so it was a little rough.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fresh out of school, so I wasn't in the union. They were paying us next to nothing.
But you were working.
But I was working, mm-hmm. And I was there from May through Labor Day. And it was there, and we did three shows, and it had its ups and downs, but it was a great sort of first plunge into working, and a great place to work. And then I sort of worked in and around Toronto, did a lot of summer stock over the years. I did some film and TV and some theater, Shakespeare, and all kinds. Sort of ran the gamut of all kinds of things. And then in 2003, everything changed. And that's when I got an offer to come to the United States to do The Lion King.
Oh.
A brand new company that was starting in Chicago and would become the national tour. And I had auditioned for the show several times in Toronto. There was a permanent production or a long-running production in Toronto that I auditioned for many times but didn't get. But the same people cast all of The Lion Kings. Disney has complete control. So they kept calling my agent and saying, we like Brian a lot, but we just don't have anywhere to put him right now. It's been on for about 2 years. And I just sort of given up. I'm like, you know, it's nice that I guess they like me, but you know what?
Right.
And I just sort of moved on. And I was working. I was doing okay. I was surviving. And then one day, I was doing a production of The Miracle Worker. I remember this so well. We were doing a matinee of The Miracle Worker at the Young People's Theater in Toronto. And I checked my messages at intermission, and it was my agent saying, call me right away. And I called, and she said, Disney just called. They want you to move to Chicago.
Oh, God.
And I had no plans to leave Canada at that point. And suddenly, my agent's negotiating, and it's for a huge company. It's for Disney, for goodness sakes. And it's 2003. Lion King is still
a relatively
new show. It's
a hot show.
Right. And I'm like, my God, this is amazing. And it changed the entire trajectory of my life. And suddenly I was down here. And that was in 2003, and I'm still here.
Oh, my God. Here. Yes. So, and you wound up in New York?
I wound up in New York. I was with the show for just over 2 years, and they were very generous, and they offered me a third year, but I had sort of reached my creative peak with the show. I was tired, mm-hmm. and I was young and wanting to prove myself still, and you know what I mean? I was, like, hungry for creative.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That show is amazing. The Lion King is amazing, but really comes down to puppetry. It's about those puppets. It's not necessarily
about
the performance.
Yet again, that's so interesting,
you know what
though,
I mean?
Isn't it?
That's so interesting.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
And the first thing I did when I booked that show is I started watching The Muppets again.
Again, right.
I went out and I got the DVDs or whatever and started watching The Muppets because it's amazing. You learn so much just by watching.
Right.
The angle of the head of the puppet tells you everything, or the way it breathes. So I was with the show for a couple of years, and then I got my green card towards the end of my second year, and I made a decision that I was going to go back to Chicago, because we were in the show started in Chicago. We were there for a year, and I wanted to be in a city where I knew I would work.
Right.
And I had made some great connections.
There's a lot of work in
Chicago, and it's such a tremendous town. I love Chicago. I call it my American hometown because it's like the first city I lived in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that city. I have a whole bunch of friends there, and it's a very special place. And so I went back and started working there and did 3 seasons with the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. They were very generous to me, and doing some other film stuff. And then after about 4 years, I don't know, I just had this itch. I loved Chicago, but I felt I had sort of at least seen what it was and what it had to offer for the moment. And I don't mean that to sound like a judgment. I think it's a tremendous town, but I just wanted to see what else was going on.
Yeah.
I got this green card, which I worked really hard to get,
mm-hmm.
and I want to, maybe this isn't where I'm supposed to be. I want to go on a little adventure and see what's going on. So I picked up and I moved to New York, and that's when the serious struggling sort of started. The first 2 years were not very kind to me. It was hard. It was very hard.
But you stayed.
But I stayed, because there was something in me that said stay. And believe me, I thought on it, I meditated on it, I'm like, am I supposed to be here? What am I doing? What's happening? Am I being punished? have I led from my ego? Is that what I've done? I've come here to, like, make it? Is, like, what's going on?
Right.
But there was just something, one of my best friend in the world, she came to New York for a visit when I was sort of in a pretty low period, and we were out for a long walk. And she looked at me and she said, you know, it's okay to go back to Chicago. And I said, I know it is. I said, but I have to tell you, I'm not supposed to go yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, I can't even give you a reason. I can't point to something and say, this is why. It's just a gut feeling. Yeah. I'm not supposed to go yet.
And you honored it.
And I honored it. And I continue to. And one of the things I'm realizing, because it's almost 5 years, it'll be 5 years this coming fall that I moved to New York, that I moved to New York, yes, for work purposes, but I thought that was the primary reason I was moving to New York. But I was moving to New York because I had some growing up to do. I had to mentally, emotionally, all of it. There was some purging that needed to happen, and I needed to get a little deeper, I guess. That sounds cliche, but do you know what I mean?
I don't think
I needed to get to know myself.
It had been so easy for you.
It had been relatively easy.
And so you hadn't had to see what you're made of.
And this has shown me what I'm
made of. That you can tough it out. You can take it, right?
Yeah.
Right. You can survive the despair, the questioning, the all that stuff.
Yeah.
You can do it. I don't think saying that going deeper is a cliche. I think it's the truth.
And what I have found, and actually I feel it significantly working on this piece, working on Heidi and playing this role, that living through what I've lived through in the last few years has helped me to get in touch with some deeper emotions and a deeper understanding of life and people and what makes people tick and what their motivations may or may not be. And it is impacting my work in a very positive way. I feel like I'm bringing something more to my work that I didn't have before. When you're lucky, you're with an actor, an actress, whomever is in that moment and is present with you, and you don't have to play mind games. But this is what I say when it comes down to training and like technique, and you need to have a couple of tricks in your bag,
right?
For when the chemistry just is not here. But I have to have these emotions. They have to be real because I can't fake them.
No,
I fake it, and they all will smell it. And I don't want to. It makes me feel like I'm doing a bad job. And so my objective is to make these emotions very real.
Acting is a job. It's a technique. It's an art.
It is an art.
Right?
Like painting, like sculpting, like you need to have teachers who show you the way,
talking about something else. I'm saying if you're painting and you learn a technique, it's you and the canvas. You got the technique, you can do it. I mean, you know, it's not the canvas isn't going to make it difficult for you. That's not going to give you bad direction. But with acting, you never know if you're going to find yourself in a situation with a director that doesn't like you, with an actor you don't like, with people...
There are variables over which you have no control.
No control. And so...
It's a collaborative art form.
It's a collaborative art form. And you always have to be able to use your technique, whatever it is, in whatever situation you find.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you get this?
This part?
Yeah.
I was doing a production at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and a New York casting director that the Oslo uses called and said, this part for you in this play, can you put yourself on tape? Because I couldn't make it to the audition because, of course, I was working. Quickly threw it on tape. It was actually the opening night of the show that I was doing in Milwaukee. I had next to no time to prepare. I focused for a couple of hours and just did it, threw it on tape, emailed it to Stephanie, and 2 hours later I had a job offer.
Wow.
I've never gotten anything that fast. But which made me go, okay, I guess this is supposed to be happening.
Right.
And then sort of looking at the time frame, wait, you want me to be in Florida from mid-December to late March? Okay. What do I need to do to book this time slot every year? I made a mistake. The week between Christmas and New Year, I had the week off because one of the other shows was teching and getting ready to open, and so we didn't have any rehearsals because some of our cast are in that show, or those shows. And so I had a whole week off. I'm like, I'm going to go home. I'll have New Year at home. I was off that plane in New York for about 5 minutes, and I thought, I have made the worst mistake of my life. It was awful.
I
didn't leave the apartment. It was terrible. We digress.
We do. There's one other question that I ask, and that is, having given a life, and you really have given your life from very little, you really have given a life to this work. The work of creating characters, the work of being in front of audiences, the work, right? Is there anything you would say about what that's like?
It's marvelous, and it's trying. When it's great, it's the best feeling in the world. But it does come with struggle, and it comes with, sort of like I said, I think to survive as an artist, I think really no matter what your art form is, whether you're an actor or a painter or a writer, the thing about the arts is that it tests you. It makes you go deep. It's hard. How can you not be introspective and be an artist? It's you become your own, you know, psychiatrist. When you're not analyzing characters, you tend to analyze yourself. It's true. It's almost like you're constantly looking for what you're supposed to be analyzing next, and when there's no target, it usually goes inwards, which can be a good thing, and sometimes it's not. But I would say I love what I do. I'm grateful that I'm so far I'm doing it. It's been over 10 years since I started this journey, and I sometimes marvel at that. And when I do feel down and start to wonder, like, oh gosh, what am I going to do next? Why didn't I book that job? Or get stressed out, or try to collect myself and look back at that and try to give myself a little pat on the shoulder, something that I'm not terribly good at, but I'm getting better. I'm just like, look at what you've done so far.
Right.
Be grateful.
Have some perspective.
Have some perspective. And this is also the industry, that some there are booms and busts, and that, and you there's no predicting it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You really don't know. What I love about it, and also what somewhat stresses me out about it, is you have to live in the moment.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what that, the phone is going to ring tomorrow with a job offer or an audition for something that you never even thought would happen. And suddenly you're off and you're doing it.
It is one day at a time.
It is one day at a time. And I think that's the challenge as an actor. I think when you're performing, that is absolutely, to be a good actor, you have to be in the moment. You have to be completely present with this person. I think it's very much a channeling sort of experience, that it's just, you have to be present. And in life, I think actors try to be, but it's difficult because you're constantly thinking about the next gig, the next gig. I got to book it. I got to get it. It's amazing how actors can actually, in their daily life, get completely away from it. But on stage can be incredibly present, which is why I think a lot of actors are most happy when they're on stage, because they know where they are.
Right. They don't have to think about
it. They don't have to think about
it. Actually, they don't have to think about anything. That's right.
They just have to be.
That's right.
As long as you learned your lines.
That's right. You're there.
Just be.
That's right. So that's the challenge, isn't it? To take what you know as a professional.
Into your life.
Into your life.
Mm-hmm.
That is a challenge.
And some days I'm really good at it. And some days I'm really bad at it. But such is life, you know.
Well, but I think actually you're ahead of the game if you know that that's something that you you would benefit from doing.
Yeah.
Not everybody knows that.
Yeah. True.
You know. So, and you're not that old. So you can still develop that more and more.
Yeah.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I didn't ask you, but I was thinking, are you not writing?
I'm trying to. It's funny. It's something that sort of got away from me. When I was younger, I was writing stuff all the time. And it's something that I've sort of gotten away from. And I started to try to do some writing over the last few years. I need to build it up again. And also to start reading writers that I admire and would like to emulate. And I know it's something I'm supposed to do, but I don't...
Are you afraid?
I think a little bit.
What of?
When you're an actor, it's somebody else's words. It's somebody else.
And
I'm just interpreting it. I'm just the...
Vehicle.
The vehicle. When it's writing, it's mine. It's my words.
Yes.
That's what's on the chopping block. Do you know what I mean? For up there for judgment. And
that's really interesting because you're up there on the chopping block. I know it's somebody else's words,
but still,
it's your body and your face and your mouth. You know, I mean,
you can still screw it up.
Isn't so much that you can screw it up. It's that you seem to have to feel, I don't know how to say this, safe enough, confident enough in your ability as an actor that they're not going to judge you harshly. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand that it's somebody else's words, but you're the face that people are...
Yeah, it's still, your interpretation is still up for judgment.
Thank you.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
But you feel okay about that. You feel safe about that.
I for the most part, I do.
Well, you couldn't keep doing what you were doing if you...
No.
You know.
And that, I like to think at this point, I'm starting to get... Was it John Gielgud always said, what does it take to be a good actor? And I think he said 40 years,
mm-hmm.
or 20 years. I can't remember exactly the quote, but it's something significant like that. And more I realize how true that is.
Mm-hmm.
And that with age and experience, both on stage and off stage.
That's right.
How can you play grief if you haven't grieved? How can you play heartbreak if you haven't had your heart broken? How can you play in love if you haven't really been in love? When you know those things, and the older I get, the more I experience all of those things, the great happiness of life and the great sadness of life, to be able to pull on those and go, I know those. I know this character's pain in this moment. I know what he feels. I can relate to it. Or at least relate to, if you can't relate to the scenario personally, you can at least relate to that emotion that he is feeling. And I look forward to deepening that, and that continues to be my goal, is to be as I continue to develop my authentic self, that authenticity carries into my work, I hope.
I think that's a lovely place to stop. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to meet you.
As I continue to develop my authentic self. Well, there it is. That's just another way of saying, as I continue to be who I really am. And this, of course, is the reason that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because these are people who are dedicated to discovering, finding, using their authentic or very real self. And so, as I have said many times, when you hear them talk about their work, their commitment to their work, you hear what you hear in Brian, the desire to go deeper, to find more and more of your authentic self. And as Brian also describes when we talk about the possibility of his writing, it's scary. It's scary to put your authentic self on the chopping block. Well, it can only be scary to do that if you've had an experience which has said, don't do that. Of course, Brian had one of those with his voice teacher who slapped him and other students down when they presented their authentic self. But Brian was also lucky enough to have teachers who applauded, encouraged, were delighted by his authentic self. And so you can see that he was given the gift of, yeah, go for it. And also a little bit of the, watch out, don't do that. So, are you wondering when in your childhood, in your family, in your school experience, your culture or your religion? I have clients whose religions tell them that joy is the devil's work. So they're afraid of it. Is there an experience in your life that taught you to hide your authentic self? Do you want to try and recover that? Knowing that that experience is likely to be scary. But in my experience, so very worth it. Well, I think we've made the point of the Lynn Show today, for which I am very grateful. And now I'm going to play a review of the Heidi Chronicles, written by Sharon Leslie, which I am reading. Once upon a time, there was a woman named Heidi who chose not to do the expected. She chose not to be the fairy tale princess who finds and marries her Prince Charming and lives happily ever after. Well, does that mean that a woman cannot live happily ever after if she chooses to pursue a career and remain single? Such is the situation posed by Wendy Wasserstein in The Heidi Chronicles, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play that follows the life of Heidi from high school in 1965 to art history professor at Columbia in 1989 and respected writer on women in art. But real life is never a fairy tale. Wasserstein has crafted a smart serial comedy that tackles women's issues not in the abstract, but the highly personal, through the life of Heidi Holland. Heidi falls in and out of love with Scoop Rosenbaum, a handsome but arrogant go-getter. She maintains a long-term friendship with the pediatrician Peter Petrone, who comes out of the closet and later has to deal with the AIDS epidemic. Her friend Susan bops in and out of her life because various jobs take her all over the United States. In the end, Wasserstein reflects on the consequences of the career woman's choice. In order to be a complete woman, perhaps find happiness and a deeper sense of purpose, does she have to also experience motherhood? In this play, the answer is yes, but not in the traditional way. Heidi adopts a child and becomes a single mom. Theatrically, the Oslo Repertory Theatre has created a visually exciting production of this play. With 13 set changes and over 200 costume changes for the cast, the transitions from scene to scene are inspired journeys that quickly establish elapsed time and change of place. Different rock songs set the mood and the developing style changes. We go from preppy to psychedelic to disco to punk and beyond. Many of the actors are outstanding. Brian Sills is engaging as the cynical but lovable Peter Petrone. Zachary Fine is charismatic and charming as the arrogant Scoop Rosenbaum. As Heidi's best friend, Susan, Gail Rostifer brings lots of energy and a sense of fun to the driven career woman role. Several characters play multiple roles with great aplomb, changing accents and attitudes. Lindsay Torquist is particularly funny as the pregnant friend from Brooklyn. As Heidi, Elizabeth King Hall brings a subtle touch to this complex leading lady role. I love the Oslo's choice to include the Heidi Chronicles in their season. It is a play that questions where we have been and where we are going as women, a question that I hope will keep audiences talking long afterward. So, if you never had the opportunity to see the Heidi Chronicles or Brian Sills, you should run right out and take advantage of the opportunity to do both at the Oslo Repertory Theatre current production. I want, at this point, as always, to thank the unbelievable, indomitable Josh Hackney, who can literally do anything. I currently did something that made my iPhone erase everything. Josh will come to the rescue. He found the software that I am currently talking to you on. He built the computer that the software is in. There is nothing he can't do with any kind of technology. I currently have a lot of technological needs and very little technological savvy. So I am grateful beyond measure to have access to Josh. If you have any technological needs, you should take advantage of Josh as well. And you can get him, as you can get me, on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Remember not to leave the E out of Lynn. You get a different The Lynn Show if you do. Also remembering that on my website, you can not only get a hold of me and Josh, but you can listen to and download this show and all of the other shows. You can find out about psychotherapy on the phone. There are lots of things you can do on the website. But now, we're going to go out on another example of Brian singing. And I want to say how grateful I am that the school was smart enough to fire that teacher so that we did not miss out on this extraordinary talent. But right before I stop, I want to say, as I always do, that I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you would be great, but something that made you laugh or interested you, something you didn't know that you learned, something that you knew but had forgotten, something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, as always, and I hope you will be, too.
There's nothing like a good old-fashioned war. A true today is in those famous days of yore. You only have to cast your mind back to the Roman and the Greek. It laid their world to waste, and still they found it magnifique.
A good old-fashioned thing to fight and die.
And better yet, let's not forget the reason why. When the roll of honor's taken, one thing makes us proud, and that's we've helped to save the bacon of some fine aristocrats.
How grand it is to hear the cannon roar. War, there's nothing like a good old-fashioned war.
Oh,
a good old-fashioned war is here to stay.
It's just the job to give the mob a role to play.
They're little more than cattle when no fighting's to be done. But need them for a battle. Look, they're heroes, everyone.
It's sacrifice to free the strayed corn. For there's nothing like a good old-fashioned war. A good old-fashioned war.
You hear the drum and you succumb without a thought. And if you should have doubts, remember there's your mother old and gray. How glad she's bound to be to see you gaily march away.
That good old fashioned God is on your side. It's guaranteed in the cathedrals far and wide.
They'll sing you a Quitalis for the glory that you found. And glory's such a solace when you're 6 feet underground. Why dwell upon the carnage and the gore? Although your bones will soon be ash, a man should die with some panache. There they were. They were giants among men. It was 4 against 10, but they gave no quarter. There I was, safe behind a big tree. But what use could I be? From the tree I could see the whole field. And I saw, did they yield? No, they gave them what for without turning a hair. You can take it from me. I was there.
And is it true what they're saying about this D'Artagnan?
My master, you mean? There he is. He's the sail that all fronts. He takes 3 on at once. Does he flinch? Not likely. How it was, 1, 2, 3, they were floored. They were routed and gored. Oh! There was death in his sword on that day. Oh!
Oh! You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have got good.